Joe, where's Joe? You've done a fantastic job, Joe. My name's Richard and I'm an addict. And yeah, I sat up there with my fellows from Northamptonshire. I'm from the county of Northamptonshire. Love you guys. And because I felt safe with them, this is a big deal. And it's something that I've never done before. And I feel, how do I feel? Scared. It's a responsibility, and speaking to my friends about this responsibility, they said, just get up there and share your story, Richard. You know, you've got a story to tell, and we all have. And I guess tonight, this time, this place, it's my time to tell my story. And I'm going to try and do that in a very general way. What a wonderful event. Absolute wonderful occasion. For those that are new, I just want to really welcome you to a wonderful life-saving fellowship called Cocaine Anonymous. My sobriety date is the 20th of July 2003, and since that day I've not found it necessary to put any mind or mood altering substance inside my body, and for that I'm truly, truly grateful. What I was told when I come here, because when I come here I didn't feel wanted, I didn't feel needed, and I certainly didn't feel loved. And what I was told is that Cocaine Anonymous wants me here, Cocaine Anonymous needs me here, and Cocaine Anonymous will love me until I can learn to love myself. So for anybody that's new, I'll say the same to you. Cocaine Anonymous wants you, needs you, and will love you until you learn to love yourself. I can't believe how many people are here for this Friday. It's incredible. To be stood up here from where I come from is an absolute privilege. I'm gonna share it because I feel I just need to get it out and then move on. But I wasn't sure whether I was going to be able to make it here today. I've been going through some physical issues, and I was getting night sweats and fevers, and I went into hospital, had my appendix removed. And on Monday, I had removed a fortnight ago, on Monday the consultant called me and asked to see me. And I went in to see him, and the results of the test was that I've just been diagnosed with bowel cancer. And I need to go and have a CT scan and surgery and then chemotherapy. So I was in two minds whether to get up here and share my experience, strength and hope with you guys. But I spoke to my mum, and my mum I often go to and seek advice and counsel with her. And she said, Richard, she said, there might be somebody in that meeting that day that needs to hear what you've got to say. And what I've learned about this program and this way of life is to suit up and show up. So I went back and saw the consultant Thursday morning, and we discussed a treatment plan. Thursday afternoon, I was sitting down with a newcomer reading the second part of Bill's story. And I ain't saying that for any affirmation. I really don't need that today. I'm just sharing with you guys, this is what I've learnt that we do here in Cocaine Anonymous. No matter what, we suit up and we show up. And I know from experience that no matter what's coming my way, everything's going to be all right. And physically it might not be, but I've got faith that no matter what needs to get taken care of will be taken care of. I know that. And I've got a wonderful fellowship to lean on in this difficult time of my life. You know, I emailed my sponsor who lives out in America. I love that man. And shared with him the discussion that I had with the consultant. And he said to me, Richard, he said, men mask their fear with anger. Don't be a dick. And I'm trying not to be a dick. I've got no denial around it. And in prayer this morning, I had a little moment because in June 3 years ago, our son was born. I've got a boy called Henry, and today I just like was in prayer about thinking about my son, and I want to watch the sunrise with him and the sunset and look at the stars and the moon and travel this beautiful earth with him, and God willing, I'm going to be experiencing that with our son. So there we are. The big book tells me that we share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened to me, and what I am like today. So I'm going to share in a general way. I know I've got 45 minutes to try and cram in 46 years, so I'll do my very best. But what I used to be like before I put any drug inside my body was restless, irritable and discontent. And as cliched as that sounds, that's how I felt. You know, I heard a guy called Jack Brennan talk about being a misfit in life. And that's how I felt. I just felt that I was a misfit. I felt that there was something missing. I didn't have all the answers. And something just wasn't right within me. And who wants to feel like that? I felt insecure as a child, very low self-esteem, felt that I'd been born into the wrong family almost. And I would look at friends and look at their families and think, why don't I belong to a family like that? And I come from relatively like decent family, like two sisters, you know, folks that tried their best. I grew up on a council estate in West London. And my dad was a hard-working man, you know, tried to provide for his family. Yet I just had this underlying feeling of restlessness and irritability and discontentment. And it stayed with me throughout adolescence and into adulthood. The only relief that I would get from that was by putting a chemical inside my system. I didn't start drinking till I was 12. I was a bit of a late starter in life. I got that from Earl H the other day. I was trying to listen to a few CD shares and pick up a few tips. But I was with Jimmy Kay earlier on, and we was talking about, Jimmy was sharing about actually, about the CAUK 12, which was my first convention in Bournemouth. I used to live in Bournemouth, and we were Earl H. There's always some Bournemouth Massive in the room, isn't there? But Earl H shared at that convention, and wonderful, wonderful story that man's got. And so restless, irritable, discontent from an early age. Didn't start drinking till I was 12. It's a bottle of Pernod. Those of you that know me just kind of, I don't know, nod off for a bit, and someone give them a nudge when I've shared this bit of my story, because they've heard it hundreds of thousands of times. And it was a bottle of Pernod. I didn't think that it would be missed, because it seemed to kind of gather dust when the other bottles didn't. So I took this bottle of Pernod, and on the estate I grew up on, the primary school was there, nursery and junior school. And I went over the school field, and I remember taking a mouthful of this Pernod, and the taste of Pernod, as I'm sure most of us in the room know, It's quite sweet, aniseed. It's quite a nice taste for alcohol, because I was never really a fan of the taste of alcohol, if I'm honest with you. I was more interested in the effect. And can any of you identify with that? And I remember taking a few swigs of this Pernod, and it starting to kind of tingle in my mouth, and then down my throat, and started to kind of warm my throat up, and then down into my stomach, and my stomach started to warm up, and then all of a sudden I got the effect produced by alcohol. And I was probably about 11 or 12 years old. And from that moment, I had found the solution to the problem that I had experienced from as far back as I could remember. And I'm a kid. I don't know whether all kids feel restless, irritable and discontent, but I know I did. And I know that when I put that alcohol inside my system, something happened, you know, magical. You know, I truly believe that if I hadn't found my daughter in chemicals, I would have possibly seriously considered suicide, most certainly homicide, because I was an angry young man at 12 years old. My dad used to say to me, "What's wrong with you? Why are you so angry?" But I was a crazy mixed up kid, and as soon as I got that effect, it just took all of that away. It talks about it in the beautiful big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, who was so kind to lend us that book back in 1982. It produces a feeling of ease and comfort. And that's exactly what it produced in me. Before I forget, I just want to give a big shout out to the pioneers of CA UK, really. I'm going to miss some names, but I just want to thank the likes of Jackie S, Philip L, Niels and Carol, Richard K, Jeff, some of the Bristol crew, Victor, you know, some of the Brighton crew, Danny G, Lou G, you know, Matthew, you know, some of the members of Cocaine Anonymous in the UK that committed and sacrificed their time to create this wonderful fellowship. Because if it wasn't for them people, I don't know where I'd be. Like I said earlier on, drink and drugs were the solution to the problem that I suffered from. And I really believe that my default setting is depression. I really believe that. But what I have found today is a solution to that, which is contained within the 12 steps of Cocaine Anonymous and being of service within this wonderful, wonderful life-saving fellowship. So from age 12, I'd found my solution. And my sponsor said, "Don't stay drunk too long." He said, "People in the room all know how to get drunk and get wrecked, but I'm just trying to become an addict for the newer members in the room, and I just hope you get some identification and come back to another meeting." You know, if you are new, it suggested to me to not make a decision based on your first experience of Cocaine Anonymous, and I'll say the same to you. Please don't base your decision on what you might hear, see or feel this weekend. You know, keep coming back, and I guarantee you the miracle will happen. You know, that obsession will be removed and your life will move into a new experience, and you'll start to experience some of the wonderful promises within this big book. You know, it talks about happy, joyous and free. And despite what I've got going on for me, that's how I feel right here, right now. I feel a deep sense of gratitude to be standing up here and to be a member of this fellowship. So I just want to go through some of my early kind of school life. I was a very bright child. In school, it come easy to me. I was a grade A student. I excelled academically, but I was suffering from this condition. And that started to affect my school life. And from age 14, I'd been expelled from two schools. And I become a kind of kid living on his wits on the streets. You know, my parents were both working. And I just started to mix with some of the older kids. And like I think most of our stories, I got introduced to harder substances. And I want to go through the classes quickly, but 17 years old, I was snorting heroin. I'd been introduced to heroin, and I started snorting it with some friends from out of Kilburn. And for me, it all seemed very exciting. I didn't understand the severity or the consequences of what was coming my way. All I knew is I liked the effect produced by heroin. That's all I knew. And I was snorting heroin for about a year, and the acid house scene kind of emerged in the kind of mid to late 80s, maybe 87, 88, and I got involved in the acid house movement, which for most people that were involved in that experience was an incredible youth movement. I don't think there's been one like it for quite a while. I'm hoping that there will be some kind of movement in the youth culture soon, but I've not seen one yet. But it was a very powerful movement. And I often hear people sharing in meetings that it was the best time of their kind of addictive kind of life. But whilst I understand that, for me, and this is only my experience, I was always thinking about the rave ending, the club closing, and the drugs running out. You know, and there were times in my using when I had quantities of drugs, regardless of what the drugs was. I had enough drugs around me at times, but I was always worried about the drugs running out, because they'd become my solution to life. And I got caught up in some difficulties with the kind of guys that I was running with, and all of a sudden my supply to drugs got cut off. And then aged 19, I started to experience withdrawal symptoms from heroin. I wasn't aware that you would withdraw from heroin, and I remember going to see my brother-in-law at the time. I mean, he's a recovered criminal, my brother-in-law, but at the time he was involved in crime and drug dealing. And I went to see him and I said, "Peter," I said, I just don't feel right. I said, "I just feel ill." And he said, "Well," he said, "it's the ulcer." He said, you've got cold turkey." And I was like, "Cold turkey?" And I remember Grange Hill and Zammo and a Just Say No campaign. That always gets a laugh, doesn't it, that Just Say No campaign? But I remember that, but it didn't really register with me. It didn't register. So Peter, my brother-in-law, I love him dearly. He's turned his life around for 20-plus years now. He told me what I needed, and I remember driving onto an estate in White City and scoring, and I remember getting the bag back, and I'd given the guy £50, and I just thought, "Crikey, is that what this costs?" And I thought, I don't know how I'm going to fund it. My supply chain had been cut off. I wasn't earning huge amounts of money, so I knew there was going to be difficulties trying to fund this addiction. And so I'd done what any gangster does. I phoned my mum, and just, I can't help but share that one. Any self-respecting gangster phones his mum and said, "Mum, I'm addicted to heroin." She said, crying out loud, "I knew something was up. You better come home." And I went to see my mum, and they got me. This is my first introduction to institutions. They got me into a detox unit. My parents had moved out of London by this time and was living out in Surrey. And I ended up in a detox unit in Surrey, and it was really the start for me of trying to find a way out of the problem that I suffer with. And I was in there for about maybe 10 days. A guy come in, and he was a little bit war, a little bit way. I'm attracted to that kind of mentality. I hooked up with him. Within 10 minutes, we're in a taxi, take us to West London, and we're off to school. By the time we got back, my parents, I'm 19 years old, my parents had come to visit me. The detox unit didn't know where we were, and I ended up getting asked to leave. And for the next 12 years, my life progressively got worse and worse. And I want to kind of bring my drug using to a bit of a close, because I've got coming up 13 years of recovery that I want to share, and I've had some amazing, incredible experiences in them 13 years. But my drug life took me to a state of mind, body and soul that I am deeply, deeply grateful for, because I know for most drug addicts, I had to be pretty badly mangled before I started to really seek a higher power. And Ken Cross shares about it. I love Ken Cross share. I was hoping to get him talking at the Cocaine Anonymous World Service. I wanted him to be the after dinner speaker, but my then sponsor kind of manipulated me out of that, and we ended up getting someone else to share. It was the worst moment of my life. But anyway, I'll put a full stop on that. But Ken Cross talks about the end of his using. Ken Cross was like proper rock and roll. You know, for those that don't know, he was into the kind of music industry. You know, the fast life out in LA. He was making things happen. you know, in the music industry. And he talks about at the end of his using, he was driving around this stolen Volkswagen Rabbit. And he would go into the 7-Eleven and he'd buy a coffee, a newspaper, and he'd park up in the hills in his stolen Volkswagen Rabbit, drink his coffee, and he said he used to buy this really heavy donut that used to just sit on his stomach, you know, just to see him through that day. And he said he had nowhere to go, nobody to see, and he would read every single piece of text in the LA Times. That's how lonely that man was. And when I heard him share that, I so identified with that feeling of loneliness. You know, I didn't have a stolen Volkswagen Rabbit. What I had was a white pickup truck that had no MOT, no insurance, no tax. You know, at this time in my life, I was jobless, homeless, penniless, and hopeless. I was absolutely destitute. You know, I didn't feel wanted, I didn't feel needed, and I certainly didn't feel loved. I was a lonely, lonely man. And I remember I would go and get a bit of gear, I'd go and get a paper, probably the Sun, I'd go and get something to eat if I had enough money to buy something to eat, and I would sit, park my car in this supermarket car park right over in the corner for the fear of anybody seeing me. And I would have my gear and I would read every piece of print in this newspaper because I had nowhere to go and nobody to see. And that was September 2002, and I felt the loneliest man on this earth. And I went to see my sister Debbie. Thank God for my sisters and my parents. I mean, my dad's dead now, God rest his soul, but they saved my life, they really did, as did you guys. I went to see my sister Debbie. I was kind of residing in the county of Northamptonshire at the time. I'd had to move from all different boroughs of London because I just caused, like we do, absolute chaos. And I said to Debbie, I'm going back to London. And I said, can you give some money? I need some petrol and I need some money to get me back down there. And she said, yeah, I'll give you that. Go. And don't ever come back to see us until you've sorted this shit out because we don't want you in our life. You're nothing but trouble. You know, your father's dying from cancer. You know, your mum's like at her wit's end with her husband and with you. And for my sister to say that to me, it really kind of hit home. So I left and I'd been doing little deals every now and then, kind of hustling like we do, like scoring little Aussies of crack or little Aussies of heroin and like for small time kind of drug dealers in the county. And I phoned this lad up in Ealing and said, look, can you do us a little sample? I'm coming down, but I need a little sample. He said, yeah, all right. And I drove down to Ealing, met him in the pickup, got the sample, drove over to Ladbroke Grove, sat outside my friend's house, who coincidentally I was in rehab with in 1998, a guy called Tony Sienna. His nickname was Tony Montana. And Italian guy, and I sat outside his house, smoked this bit of cocaine, done what I used to do with the heroin. I'm an intravenous user, and then knocked on his door. Well, rang his bell, and I had, when we had left rehab, he had found somewhere to live for a housing association, but in the early part of 2000, I'd gone back there and just caused a bit of chaos, and he answered the buzzer. I actually found him on Twitter the other day. I still owe him an amends. I found him on Twitter. I just started to connect with him. He's up in Nottinghamshire now, and I said, Tony, it's Dick. And he went, what do you want, Dick? I said, I need a place to stay. He said, well, don't bring your trouble to my doorstep. And I'm aware that this is being recorded, so he told me in no uncertain terms to do one. And I pleaded with him. I said, look, Tony, please, I need some help here, mate. I'm beat. And he said, all right. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, you can come and stay here for a few nights. He said, but on two conditions. And I said, just what are they? He said, you can put your head down on my settee. He said, but you bring any drugs into this house, Dick, and you're out of here. I'll call the police on you. He said, I'm in early stages of recovery. I'm trying to get over this, because he'd since relapsed. And he said, and I'm going to these meetings. He said, I'm going to these 12-step meetings. And he said, you've got to come with me. And thank God for them conditions. And I said, all right, I'll agree to them. I didn't necessarily want to agree to the first condition, but I knew at some point I'd probably be able to find an angle where I could get him on the crack. And selfish and self-centred to the core, aren't we? So inconsiderate. And I haven't really looked over that side much, have I, everyone? And anyway, yes. Yeah, so my introduction into 12-step fellowship was as a result of going to see Tony Sienna, Tony Montana. And at the time, he had a stolen CBR 900 Fireblade, and he would jam parking meters, and we would spend all morning blitzing around West London, pulling out the coins. I mean, He was still dishonest. I mean, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And pulling all this change out of these parking meters. And then we'd go into a meeting. And I had been introduced to 12-step fellowship. At the time, it was Alcoholics Anonymous, back in 1989. When I went into that first detox when I was 19... we went to an AA meeting, and I don't remember anything. Well, I do remember a few things about it. I remember it was really smoky. You could smoke in meetings back then, and the secretary was an old boy, and he had a fantastic head of hair. So I can remember he had a real good head of hair, like silver hair, and smoked like a trooper, and where he used to flick his kind of like a wedge, a bit like a wedge, and where he used to flick it back had like a nicotine streak. And I can remember that vividly, like it was yesterday. And I can also remember the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, like a kind of crumply old kind of pieces of paper. And I can remember that. And I can also vaguely remember something magical. I can also just kind of remember that. There was something, I couldn't put my finger on it, didn't know what it was, but I had this kind of sixth sense, I suppose, even then, that there was something magical in this room. So I'd experienced 12-step, albeit briefly. And my second introduction to it was a number of years later, 12, 13 years later. So me and Tony started going around to all different meetings. And I started to see, for the first time really ever, because all the people that I used to knock about with were just a bunch of drug addicts like me. You know, some of them ain't here anymore. So I started to see people who had managed to stop using. And not only stop using, start to get a quality of life that I felt that I deserved. I feel like we all deserve. So I suppose looking back, I didn't understand at the time, but looking back, I started to understand the principle of hope. You know, the principle of our second step. So I suppose looking back with hindsight, I started to come to believe in the 12-step program. And As a result of suffering from this condition, I wasn't able to meet Tony's first condition of not using drugs. And I ended up took a crack dealer back to Tony's house. Like I said, I would have got Tony on crack. And that's why I'm in amend. And was asked to leave. I mean, he nearly got evicted from that property. And and he asked me to leave, and it was the best thing he ever done. I'd spent periods on the streets in London. You know, I'm a survivor of the West End. You know, I've got such a colourful story. We all have. You know, I could write a book. You know, I lived in the West End for about 3 years. You know, just going wherever I could, getting whatever I could, just surviving. So I had experience of homelessness, but Tony had told me that he didn't want me at his place anymore. So I didn't know what to do other than to go to a meeting. And at the time, I used to go to a meeting in Ladbroke Grove in the Den. And there was a Glaswegian that used to be in all the time. His name's Charlie. I've since seen him. I'm forever indebted to that man, because one day I was in a meeting in Narcotics Anonymous, and I'm not endorsing Narcotics Anonymous. You know, I'm just sharing my experience. I'll have anything with an A after it, but my home and heart and service is within Cocaine Anonymous. I don't do any other 12-step meetings unless I'm out of town. But this particular time I was in a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, and I went into the toilet, and they used to have a saying, leave your paraphernalia outside. And I think, right, they need me, they've asked me to take my paraphernalia and stick it outside. Well, I better do that. So I'd go outside and make sure no one was looking, and plop me gear up, if I was lucky enough to have any, and plop me a bit of gear up, and then I'd be in the meeting paranoid that someone from the meeting would plop me. So if anybody got up to go out of the meeting, I'd be up. And just, so I stopped doing that, and I used to have it on me in the meeting, and if you're like me, and you suffer from this craving, this phenomenon of craving, you know, as soon as I have a hit, I want another hit. So I'd go in the toilet, and in the end, I was like a Coke can crack addict. You know, like punching holes in a Coke can and sucking on a Coke can in the toilet. And I remember I was in this meeting in the Den, and I just got carried away. And I was smoking cocaine in the toilet, and all of a sudden, bang, bang, bang on the door, and it's Charlie. He's like, Dick, get the fuck out of there. I said I wouldn't swear. But he's Glaswegian, so I should be excused. So, no offence to any Glaswegians. But Charlie told me in no uncertain terms to get out of the toilet. And basically, I'd smoked out the meeting. And it's just like the shame. I've since made amends. And he said to me, he said, look, Dick, he said, I need to have a serious word with you. He said, have you eaten today? I said, no, I haven't. So I'm talking about acts of love here. You know, he said, well, come on, look, I need a bit of food. Come and keep me company. And he took me to a Moroccan gaff. I was there a little while ago, actually, on the Goldbourne Road. And we're sitting down eating, and he said, look, Dick, I need to tell you a few home truths. He said, you've been coming a while now. He said, but are you aware that the first thing you need to do is stop taking drugs? I said, you're having a laugh, aren't you? He said, no, I'm deadly serious, Rich. He said, have you thought about stopping taking drugs? I said, no, I haven't, Charlie. He said, well, why not? I said, because I can't live life without drugs, mate. I've tried it. Don't work. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I just can't seem to cope with how I feel. I said, it's intolerable. He said, I know. He said, because I've experienced that myself before. At the time, he was about 18 years. He's 30. He's 30 years now, Charlie, 30 plus. And he said to me, this is why, Richard, you need to start having a little think about what it is that you want from us. He said, because coming to meetings is great. He said, but that's not what this is about. He said, if you think it's just about sitting in a meeting and trying to get a little bit of respite from the chaos that you're causing yourself, he said, you've got it all wrong, mate. He said, I'm gonna put something to you right now. He said, I want you to have a think about it. He said, I can get you a bed in a hospital right now. What do you want to do? I said, I'll have to get back to you on that, Charlie. He said, yeah, I thought you might. He said, I can tell you're a busy man. You've got a few business deals you need to tie up. Piss taker. He said, so I'll tell you what, Dick. He said, here's my number. He said, when you really are serious about this, he said, give me a call. And 2 days later, I phoned him up and said, look, Charlie, I'm serious about it. He said, all right. He said, meet me tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. Outside this hospital, up on the Euston Road. And I turned up at 9 o'clock, and he turned up like he said he would, and he took me to hospital, and I went through the most horrendous detox ever. If there's anybody detoxing in this room tonight, my heart goes out to you. I never ever want to experience the pain and suffering of my last detox. And I know from experience that I never ever have to go back there. My first sponsor, I'm going to give him a little shout out because I love this man, Chris Cross. He said to me when I met him in Brighton, when he offered to sponsor me, he said, "Dick," he said, "I promise you, mate," he said, "the feelings you felt that got you in through the doors," he said, "you never have to experience them again." He said, "I promise you that." And he kept his word. So, like Charlie did. And I ended up in this crisis unit, it's called. Some of you might be familiar with it. It's on the city road, up in, I think it's M1. And I walked in there, and as soon as I walked in there, I felt this huge weight just lift off of me, just as a result of being in this place. You know, how long have I been sharing for? Anybody keeping a clock? 35 minutes. I've got 10 minutes. This is going to be tough. I'll do my best. And whilst I was in there, Cocaine Anonymous come into that meeting place, and I was reintroduced to fellowship. Whilst I was there, Charlie suggested to me that maybe a little course of treatment would be a good idea. And he said to me, we can support you in that. And I ended up, here comes a big shout out for the Bournemouth Massive, moving to Bournemouth in 2003. And whilst in another hospital there, my then sponsor came in just brimming with confidence. And he sat down, and he was from West London. He was a QPR fan. He was into graffiti. He was into acid house. And he just had something going on. And I knew that this man was there to help me. But I didn't have the ability to say, "Look, please help." You know, and I'm just going to put this out here. It tells me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that I approach the still suffering addict. I don't wait for the still suffering addict to come to me and ask me for help. It's just not our role. I approach the newcomer that comes into the meeting place, and this man did that day. He said, "Look, if you want, I can show you a new way of life." And he said, "Why don't you meet me Wednesday night at my home group?" It was the Big Book study meeting. The Fourth Dimension Big Book Study Group. Little shout out for the Fourth Dimension in Christchurch. I said, "Why don't you meet me there and we can have a little chat about the process?" And I met him there and we had a little chat about the process. And then I would meet him every week and we would pick up that big book and we would read it together, sharing our experience, strength and hope. And I remember leaving him every week feeling a little bit better, a little bit lighter, and a little bit more hopeful. And I'm forever indebted to that man for sacrificing his time. I'm a big believer in working with others. My sponsor says, "That's all there is, Richard. That's all there is. It's what this is about. Carrying the message to the addict that still suffers, sitting down with another man, opening that big book, sharing your experience, strength, and hope." I'm a big believer in that. And that's what that man done for me. And I remember writing out my step four. I'd done my step four in 2 hours. And going to share it with him. And it was quite a lengthy piece of material. And he said, "Look, I'm sharing in Brighton." And we got in a car and we drove to Brighton. We went round Danny and Lou's house. Met them. You know, he started introducing me to this beautiful fellowship. He started taking me to prison meetings. He started taking me to hospital and institution committee meetings. He introduced me to the heartbeat of Cocaine Anonymous and said, "Richard, this is what I'll do. You know, if you want what I've got, this is what you need to do." And I did. I wanted what he had. He had a lot to offer. He was an attractive man in many ways. And so I started to do what he'd done. And I remember at the time, the GSRs in Bournemouth was having to drive to London to go to area, so we spoke to Scouse Paul and we set up a little unity committee in Bournemouth. There was only a few of us there, And the sad thing is, I don't think many of them are still with us. That's the reality. Who's that? Who are you? AD. AD is still here. Good to see you, AD. But, AR Colin? Who's that, Dave C? Yeah, you weren't there, Dave. No, Dave was there. Dave was there. I'll tell you about it. But what I'm saying is that a bunch of what was hopeless drug addicts started to think, hold on a minute, we need to do something. We've got something here that we need to carry this message further afield. And from that, a fellowship has just continued to mushroom. And since my time around, I've seen this fellowship just continue to grow and grow and grow. I mean, we was out in Ireland last year. Just incredible. There's some Irish in here. Yeah, we was out in Dublin. And the fellowship in Dublin, I mean, I remember when there wasn't a meeting in Dublin. I remember when the lads come over here around 2006, 2007, there or thereabouts. Just absolutely mushroomed across Europe, Holland, Sweden, Israel, Russia. You know, just incredible growth. You know, just from some people thinking, hold on a minute, we've got something special here. We've got something that saves people's lives. Sounds very dramatic, but that is the absolute reality. And in 2008, my phone's ringing. It's my brother-in-law, Pete, the reformed criminal. Love that man. I proposed to my missus on Valentine's Day. Yeah. All right. Just... That fear of commitment's a big one, isn't it? But I got down on one day. I'm just going to share. We I planned it. I thought, right, we're going to London. We'll have a nice bit of food. I'll take her to Laddery. I'll get her some little... She likes these cakes that they do in Laddery up near Harrods and that. And I said, then we'll go in the London Eye. And I'll get down on one knee and I'll propose. It was freezing. It was Chinese New Year. It was absolutely chock-a-block. We spent about 3 hours traipsing around trying to find somewhere to eat. We finally found somewhere to eat, which was horrible. We got back to the car, said to her, let's go to the London Eye. She went, do you know what? She said, I just want to get home, put my dressing gown on. And so I proposed to the missus with us both in our dressing gowns. Yeah. And, so when we get married next year, all being well, my brother-in-law's going to be my best man. And, so 2008, and I'm aware I'm running out of time. My dad, who passed, God rest his soul, Thomas, his name was, our son's Henry Thomas, was dying from cancer, and at the time, I wasn't really practicing the principles of the program. I was suffering from depression, but I was sober, start raving mad, and I just got caught up in some stuff that with hindsight I shouldn't have, but I did, and I've cleared up that wreckage. But at the time, like, everything, the stars aligned, and a job offer come up in Northamptonshire, and part of my amends was to create a fellowship in the county. So 2008, I moved everything, and for the first 6 months, I'd moved from a vibrant, thriving fellowship in Bournemouth. I thought I'd made a terrible mistake, but in prayer and meditation, my missus takes a piss out of me, because there's a bit in the big book that says, though you may be one man with a book in your hand, you have tapped into a power greater than yourself. And I say it to missus, I'm one man with this book in my hand. She's so Richard, like, give it a rest. And I remember I landed in the county and thought, right, well, what do? Well, we get to a meeting. And I walked into a meeting, and there was Pete, who's still with us today, and you could just tell he was pissed off. He'd had enough. He'd really tried with all his will and heart and vigour to create a fellowship in that county. And I walked in, and he said it was like he'd been praying. He said it was like this vision for you, of me walking in. He said, with this big scarf on, I like a scarf. And at the time, I think I was about 4 or 5 years maybe, and he asked me to share. And me and Pete, after the meeting, got together, and we started to see how we could take this message further afield. And we started getting in touch with our wonderful friends, the media. We started to go to the radio stations, started to go to the press, and just started going out there and getting this message out there. And all of a sudden, people started trickling into the meeting. And we used to get despondent because people would come and people would go. And I was talking, I think it was to Niels earlier on, he said when they set the Bromley meeting up, him and Richard, he said they'd given away something like 90 newcomer chips, but there's still him and Richard sitting there. I was like, what's going on? And Niels said he used to blame Richard, and Richard used to blame Niels. But we made a decision that we was going to give it another year and persevere through that. And we did. We persevered, and then we started catching other people. And the meeting there, I was in there this Thursday. You know, you suit up and show up when you're going through difficult times, you're going through good times, in different times, what we do. And I sat there, and I looked around, and it was like a standing room only. I mean, the lads that are involved in that meeting, they said that, no, Richard, that was quite a quiet meeting. Usually we have to go and get all the chairs from downstairs. Well, I sat there, lads, and I thought, we've got a fellowship that I crave in this county. We've got 5 meetings in the county now, and there is an absolute wonderful, vibrant fellowship which is full of newcomers. They're all lit up with this way of life and going out, taking names and numbers. And Rashid, if Rashid is in here, I was having a nice little sauna earlier on, sitting in the old hot tub, making the most of it. And I was listening to this young lad, I don't know, maybe mid-20s, sharing with this bloke that was with the Vamps, over gigging over there, and he's a magician, Rashid, and he started talking, and I tuned in, and we got talking, and Rashid was like 111 days, he's gone through the programme, and now he's sitting down with another man, taking another man through the 12 steps, and that's what goes on here, it's what we do. Like my sponsor said, that's it. We turn up to a meeting. The whole purpose of me turning up to a meeting today is to wait for that man, woman, that still suffering addict, walking through that door and to be an example of Cocaine Anonymous. And trust me, I ain't up here tonight to tell you how great I am. I like that hat. I'm up here tonight to tell you how great Cocaine Anonymous is. That was a random thought that came out of left field. And I shared it. I had this guy share once, if there was such a thing as thought police, he'd be getting arrested every minute. But my thoughts are cleaning up as a result of prayer, meditation, inventory, but more importantly, sitting down with another drug addict, sharing my experience, strength and hope, because I learn so much in that process about myself. Now, as a result of that, I become more loving and tolerant, which I suppose is the essence of this wonderful way of life. So my sponsor said to me to get up there and share your story, and that's what I've tried to do tonight, share just a little bit of my story. I'm here all weekend, and I'm happy to sit down and share more with you. You know, I know these events can be very overwhelming for the newcomer, even for me at times. You know, I always like going into a marathon meeting, just plugging in and just centering myself. But I'll never forget this reading, which I'm just about to finish on. My sponsor is a guy called Bill C, who lives out in LA. Lulu. Lulu's from LA. Lulu's a member of my home group. And Bill, I was at the time I was living in a bail hostel, and I went to see my friend Del, who died, God rest his soul. And I used to go there, and he used to love Jimi Hendrix. And I went there, I said, Del, I've been given this tape, a guy called Bill C. I said, can we listen to it? He said, let me just finish this album out, Rich. He had about 300 albums. And patiently, I laid back on his settee listening to a bit of Jimmy. And eventually it ended. And then he put this tape in. And And I listened to the tape, and then Bill shared this at the end of it, and it just resonated with me. And this is something that I firmly believe in, and I truly believe that I'll try to practice in my life concerning Cocaine Anonymous. And it's called I Stand By The Door. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. I'm sure some of you are. It's written by a guy called Sam Shoemaker, who was a friend of AA, come from the Oxford group. So I'm just going to read this out. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. I might bubble up reading this. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they as much as I crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it, so I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing any man can do is take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch. Crisscross, that's what you've done for me. I love you for that. The latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside that door as starving beggars. They die on cold nights in cruel cities in the dead of winter. Die for what of want is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it. Live because they have found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. Go in, great saints. Go all the way in. Go way down deep into the cavernous cellars and way up into the spacious attics in a vast, roomy house. This house is where God is. Go into the deepest of hidden casements, of withdrawal, of silence, of sainthood. Some must inhabit those inner rooms and know the depths and heights of God and call outside to the rest of us how wonderful it is. It's getting to the end now. Sometimes I take a deeper look in, sometimes venture a little further. I do. But my place seems closer to the opening, so I stand by the door. The people too far in do not see how those that are leaving, preoccupied with the wonder of it all. Somebody must watch for those who have entered the door but would like to run away. So for them, I too stand by the door. I admire the people who go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not even found the door, or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall keep my old accustomed place near enough to God to hear him and know he is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them and remember they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them, millions of them, but more important for me, one of them, two of them, three of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch. So I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. Thanks for listening.